Former Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson joins the show. Hey, Eddie, how you doing on this Monday afternoon?
I'm good, man. I've been doing a little spring cleaning. How you doing today?
Spring cleaning? Is that what I heard you say?
Yeah. Lots of fun.
It's got to be done, Eddie. It's got to be done. But at least spring sounds pretty nice. That word alone is a very nice thought, isn't it? And nice temperatures, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the news is not good. One of the reasons we brought you on is because I know you've been so outspoken about mental health issues within the police department. And I know the police department was reeling when one officer committed suicide inside the police station within the week or so. And now we just had another one, second officer in 1 week,
yeah,
commit suicide. It is so tragic to hear. Wonder what we think.
I tell you this, Anna, I don't know why this is, but it seems like when it happens, it does tend to occur in spurts like that, and it's just a sad thing. And I tell you, one of the things that made me a little reluctant to being the superintendent was because you feel so much empathy and compassion when you lose police officers on your watch, whether it's, death by somebody else's hands or they commit suicide, so you're always wondering, what can you do to help prevent those types of things? And it's just difficult. It's a difficult situation, and all you can do, first of all, you can never do too much, but I know while I was superintendent, I looked at it, and like you said, I was very outspoken about it because, mm-hmm, a few of my friends committed suicide, and you're left wondering if there was something you could have done or said to them to help them through, whatever tribulations they're going through. But one of the things I knew we needed to do with CPD at the time was put more focus on it. So I always thought, at the time we had about a little over 13,000 sworn members and a few thousand civilian members. And we only had five licensed clinicians, including the head of the program. And so I was able to, at the time, talk to Rahm Emanuel, who was the mayor then, and he didn't have an issue with it. He wanted to do all he could. So we were able to hire seven more licensed clinicians to bring the total up to 12. And, when you have a staff of that many, 12 is still insufficient. Mm-hmm. So my goal actually was to try to get it up to about 25 because I wanted to create a situation to where the clinicians could actually be assigned to the units throughout the city, and they would start going to those units, on a weekly basis just to familiarize themselves with the officers so the officers wouldn't feel any kind of anguish when they did need to reach out to someone. I wanted them to know there was a face that they can talk to. But I have to tell you, too, that Father Brandon, the chaplain's unit, really kind of bridge that gap too, because they want to go out every Wednesday night, he would come back to me and we would talk, and just some of the things that the officers would share with him let me know that we just had to do better in terms of mental health.
Yeah, and he's a trusted person. I know that to be true. I just, like
exactly.
You say, though, a handful of clinicians and, 13,000 officers, it doesn't seem enough. But I think one of the things that you were you made great strides, and you made it there less of a stigma around talking about it. I remember
Right.
You put those promotional
Yeah.
videos out. You talked about your own feelings, the trauma that you had felt from
Yeah.
what you experienced on the job, and that means something.
It does, because I came up through CPD, so I saw a lot. And I tell you, I don't know if you remember when Conrad Gary and Eduardo Marmoleo was struck by that train, that Metro train, and was killed. And myself and, command staff members went and retrieved, their bodies. And one of the reasons that we did that was because we didn't want their colleagues that they sat next to in roll call every day to see them like that. But one of the things that came out of it, when we were up there on those railroad tracks that night, I saw in the faces of some of those command staff members that this was tough. And so we had a briefing about a month later, and Dr. Sobo, our head clinician, he kind of hosted it. And it was about 40 of us in there, about 40 command staff members. And so we started talking about mental health. And initially, everybody was quiet, so I had to lead the way on it. So I started talking about, emotional issue I had, years ago when I was a sergeant in my first marriage, and I pulled over one night Now, I never had any thoughts of suicide, but I knew I had to get this off my chest because it just felt like an anchor holding me down. So I called EAP, you know, the Employee Assistance Program, the hotline, and I talked to a counselor for about 2 hours that night, and I felt a lot better. But with me sharing that story, then quite a few other exempts shared stories of suicidal thoughts, you know, and they made it through. So we put together that video to let the rank and file know, yeah, you might have issues like that coming up through the ranks, but look at us. It didn't prevent us from moving up. And more importantly, don't be afraid to reach out and talk to someone. So I thought we were making great strides, and I don't know where they are right now, but hopefully they're continuing that progress.
Yeah, you hope so. Some of the officers cited in articles about this say that they feel more pressure to be a police officer today. Obviously, there's more scrutiny on police, and a lot of that is that we understand the reasons for it, but it doesn't take away that the good officers still feel that additional layer of stress. And some of them I've talked to privately will just tell you, you never forget some of the things you see on the job. That never leaves you, and that stays with you, and now you have this new layer. What do you think about that, Eddie?
Yeah, that's true. You know, and now we have the anti-police sentiment going across the country. It's settled down a bit, but I'll tell you, Anna, I was a sergeant in the detective division in Area 4 for 7 years, and part of that time I was in homicide. And when I got promoted to lieutenant, I have to be honest and tell you, and I share this with officers, I actually had a sigh of relief because you can't unsee the things that you see, and I just got tired of seeing some of the worst things that could happen to people in this city. I got tired of it, you know, and, you know, unfortunately, as the police, you're going to see those things throughout your career, you know, and you can't, you know, what do you do with it? You know, it's difficult to come home and share it with your family. So, you know, you go to the bars and you talk to your colleagues about it, you know, because they understand exactly where you're coming from with that. And so, that leads to alcoholism. It leads to a high divorce rate within police families, you know, and it's just a difficult thing. And then you lump on the stuff that you see nationally, like the George Floyd incident. You know, it's unfortunate because anybody that thinks that that was okay doesn't need to be a police officer. But unfortunately, you know, the majority of police get painted with that broad brush. And you have a lot of good cops out there that's trying to do the right thing, you know, and they feel a certain kind of way when they get, you know, when they get stigmatized with something like that, you know. So now, in addition, Anna, you have to remember, and I used to tell community groups all the time, when you all see cops, you just see that uniform. But these are people that have the same struggles that you do. You know, how am I going to pay the mortgage this month? You know, the kids' tuition. You know, I have a mother that's an invalid and just needs constant care. So they have the same issues that everybody else does. But then during their tour of duty, they also take on the issues of the people that they go and try to serve that particular day. So it's a tough thing. It is.
Hey, Eddie, can you stick around for another few minutes with me? I need to pause here, but I do want to ask you, the Derek Chauvin trial is going on right now, that officer who is charged with murder in the killing of George Floyd, and that's getting underway. And there's some other things, too, I want to get to, because we've got that sweeping new police reform. You good? Just hang out for a second. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, sure.
Former police superintendent Eddie Johnson is with us, 217 this Monday afternoon on WGN. We continue our conversation with former Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson, and this week marks a big week in the George Floyd saga that has gripped our nation, and lots of calls for police reforms in the wake of that, for changes to be made, and a lot of those are happening. I want to talk about those second, but first, Eddie, your thoughts about this trial, what this means to the country as all eyes are looking at Derek Chauvin, who is now charged with murder in his death.
Yeah, well, this is huge, and it'll be a monumental thing once this is all done, because this was the first time that the country saw on video and audio of you know, a police officer conducting himself in that way. And from what I saw of it, there was just no reason, absolutely no reason, to treat that man in that way. You know, and as I said before, if anybody thinks that that was okay, then they shouldn't be a police officer, you know. So I think people are looking for justice for George Floyd, and rightfully so. You know, I think that Derek Chauvin being the lead officer in that particular situation, you know, he had an obligation not to not to do things like that to make it seem okay to those younger officers, because had that video not occurred, now you may have had a situation where those young officers think that that's the way we do things, and it's simply not. So I think, you know, when it's all said and done, I do think that he's going to be convicted, and I do think he's going to have a lengthy prison sentence. And again, rightfully so, you know, because that was just, it was horrible. It mm-hmm. really was. You know, and you think about that man begging, you know, for him to get off of his neck, and he just wouldn't listen. So that should be a wake-up call to all law enforcement. And let me say, Anna, the majority of officers out there are trying to do the right thing. They really are. But do we have bad apples in law enforcement? Of course we do, just like in any profession. But I think that law enforcement has to, they just have to have an understanding that we have to start holding ourselves accountable before the rest of the public does. You know, and I think that that will cut out a lot of this stuff. And like I told you a few weeks ago, we do need police reform in certain, in certain forms and fashions. But I think it's also important to get police input when you're doing it, as well as the community's input, because it's, being a police officer is a difficult job. It's just difficult, you know, and you're always judged after something happens when you only had a few seconds to decide what to do. And sometimes mistakes are going to be made, you know, and as law enforcement officials, you have to be able to acknowledge those mistakes and not hide them, you know, be as transparent as you can and move on. You know, you fix the problem, because there is some systemic racism built into law enforcement, you know, and so we have to deal with those. You know, the reforms that the governor just, the bill that he just signed, you know, we do need reform. Let me say that. But there were certain, you know, there were some things, and I have to refresh myself on it. I apologize for not having looked at it before this conversation. But there were a few things in there that gives me pause for concern. But, you know, I would be the first to say, though, we do need police reform.
Yeah, I think that's interesting you say that, because you're seeing it on a national level. You're seeing it on a local level. Chokeholds are being banned nationally. That was allowed in Minnesota and Minneapolis at that time, I believe, when Derek Chauvin decided to do that. Of course, the way he did it and what he did, as you point out, totally seems unacceptable to what law enforcement is supposed to do. I wonder, and you do hear police officers say, when they look at all the reforms, though, that there are some things in this that are concerning for them. Some people would even say it's an anti-police bill. Like that, you've heard that, I'm sure, in the police world.
Yeah, I have. And I tell you, Anna, here's the conundrum. Yes, we do need police reform, but you can't do it in a way that makes police officers reluctant to do their job, because you want to preserve the life of citizens, but you also want to preserve the life of those police officers. So you have to sit down together and hammer that out, you know. And when we went through the negotiations for the consent decree here in Chicago, you know, Mary Emanuel was very acutely aware of not appearing to do it to the police officers as opposed to with them. So getting their input on these things is critical, you know, and they do have a lot of concern right now that, you know, if they make one wrong move, you know, even though it's a mistake, it'll not just cost them their job, but perhaps prison time. And that's a valid concern. So like I said, the reform, I haven't read the whole thing, but I'm sure there are things in there that can be tweaked a bit so that it won't, you know, turn into an environment where police officers just simply can't or are afraid to do their jobs.
Eliminating cash bail is something that has been cited. It ends the practice of people who just simply can't afford to, you know, get out, sitting there for a nonviolent crime. And I think so many of us were on board, like, wait a minute, it shouldn't, how much you make or how much, you know, being in poverty or not should not determine how long you spend in the county jail.
Right.
However, yeah, now we're hearing from court folks who are saying that in the new Illinois law that you have to, a judge is going to have to point to a specific person that you would pose a threat to in order to hold you and detain you on detaining somebody, that they have to say you're
right,
specifically going to be a threat to this person or else we can't detain you. I don't know what you make of
that. I don't agree with that. You know, you said it perfectly. You know, you shouldn't have to spend additional time in jail because you can't afford it. I agree with that. But if you have certain violent offenders out there, then it shouldn't matter that you have to point to a particular person. That person is a threat to everybody. You know, you have people out here that commit violent crime, not because they knew a person personally, but because it was a crime of opportunity. You know, so you have to consider the safety of the public at large when you make those decisions. And I hope that those judges take that into account, because there are certain folks that should be behind bars. They just should be, you know, and until we figure out a way to rehabilitate them, then that's where they have to be. But I don't think that, you know, just throwing out the cash bail system, you know, all the way around is quite the way to go. I think that, you know, these violent offenders, we have to treat them a bit differently.
Yeah, you talk about videos that made such an impact on the public. And, of course, the George Floyd video is one of them. I think locally, the Anjanette Young one, she didn't die, but the way she was treated during that wrong house search warrant, the way that whole thing went down, how did that strike you as someone in law enforcement, Eddie? Just what did you think when you saw it?
Yeah, you know, when I was a gang sergeant years ago, you know, we did a lot of search warrants. And I'll tell you this, most of the time we hit the house, people are always yelling, you got the wrong house. So that didn't alarm me at all. But we had situations where we might go into a house, because you don't know what you're going to go into until you get in there. And if, you know, you have a naked female or a naked man, for that matter, you know, you should get them clothed as soon as possible. You know, you have a female in there, you should get a female officer in there. And once you secure the location, take her in a room and let her get dressed, you know. So I you know, I don't know what was going through those officers' minds, of course. I know they have to make sure that the residence is secure for their own safety. But at the same time, you still have to be empathetic to the people that are in there, you know. So as quickly as they could, you know, I would have said, hey, let's get some clothes on this woman, sit her down on the couch, you know, make sure that area is secured, and go that route. But, you know, not having seen the entire thing, I'm not sure the time frames that things went on. But if you have somebody that's in that situation, you should try to, because you still have to be humane about things. And I'm sure that wasn't an easy thing for that woman to have to stand there for however long she stood there, you know, in that situation. So you have to be mindful of that type of thing. And I know that it doesn't happen that often, but when it does happen, you as the police, you do have to be empathetic to people.
Mm-hmm. Is it too easy to get a search warrant? Because I know that we're really trying to crack down, and the mayor has a new list of requirements. You have to go all the way up the food chain. They're saying that it gets a little sloppy on the bottom when, you know, they had the wrong house. They should have known they had the wrong house, and some other things went wrong there that day that probably could have been checked and it wouldn't have happened. I just wonder what you think about that.
Well, during search warrants, let's face it, you have to rely on confidential informants most of the time to give you that information. And in a lot of those situations, it's difficult to really check, double check, and triple check, because if you do, now you're taking a risk that the people that you're trying to get will kind of spot you and know what you're doing. So you do have to have layers of redundancy in it to ensure that you're doing the best you can. But that serving search warrants, I don't know if you can ever get to a perfect situation. You can reduce the number of bad ones that you do, but again, you're relying on informants most of the time to give you that information. And, you know, what's an informant's motivation for it? You know, you always have to ask yourself that. You know, I think now they want a deputy chief to sign off on the search warrants. I don't know if I would have went that route, because usually those deputy chiefs don't know those officers on a personal level. You know, you know, the lieutenants and captains and the commanders in those units typically know the officers better that's doing these search warrants. You know, so you have to go through the state's attorney and then, of course, get a judge to sign off on them. You know, and you don't want to overly burden those deputy chiefs. But, you know, if that's what they think is necessary, then, you know, that's their truth. But I don't, like I said, and I don't know if you can ever get to a perfect situation with search warrants, because it's just so ambiguous in that, you know, you're relying on the information of other people.
Yeah, no question. I love you getting your perspective on all these things. So I just appreciate you giving us some of your time. Are you enjoying retirement from the police department at all, Eddie? Is it
I am. Yeah, I am. You know, it's I didn't, you don't know until you get there, but retirement, right. I've talked to a few other retirees, and it's actually not a bad thing. It really isn't, so I'm kind of getting used to this.
Yeah, I bet. But you go from being so busy and so, like, on all the time to having, you know,
yep.
Sometimes that change, that swing is a little tough.
I will be honest with you in this. I still have trouble kind of sleeping at night because, you know, when you've done this for 31 years, you know, your mind is still racing, you know. So although I'm enjoying it, I probably will be doing something in the near future because I'm kind of, you know, I'm getting a little bit bored with just being at home all the time. I'll put it like that.
Well, you've got a lot to offer the world. And thank you for your perspective. Thank you for putting a spotlight on mental health the way you did. I'm sure some of the changes you made back then are paying off right now, and the officers certainly need that kind of help. So thanks, Eddie.
Yeah, hopefully. Okay, Annie, you have a great day, okay?